This is Ozarks at Large for Tuesday, August 9th, 2011. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Later on this edition of Ozarks at Large, how the continued hot, dry weather is making life hard for area farmers and ranchers. And we'll keep moving along Route 66 and take a tour of the restored Coleman Theater on Main Street in Miami, Oklahoma.
First, fundraising news from the University of Arkansas today. University officials announced this morning that the U of A's just completed fiscal year yielded private gifts of more than $121 million. That's an increase of 40% over the $86.7 million raised in the previous fiscal year. Brad Choate is the Vice Chancellor for University Advancement.
Well, I think by any measure, the University of Arkansas is doing well, particularly with philanthropy. But if you look at the quality of the faculty, the quality of the students, the numbers of students, the fact that the quality of the student body and the size are increasing significantly at the same time is really quite a statement. I mean, if an institution wanted to increase its student body size, all you'd have to do is reduce the admissions criteria. Well, you know, the quality of this student body is the highest it's ever been. And I think the faculty would probably agree that the quality of the faculty is the highest it's ever been. So, you know, we're proud of what's going on around here. We think we've got a great institution, and we're just going to get better.
The $121.3 million in private gifts for the fiscal year ending June 30th represents the largest fundraising total outside of a capital campaign in school history. The 40% increase far outpaces the national increase of 5.2% for gifts to education.
I think that, you know, we're just proud and thankful that so many kind philanthropists have supported the university so in such a magnificent way. The university is clearly an economic engine and clearly has a significant impact on the quality of life of all Arkansans, and I think that people have stepped up and voted with their checkbook, frankly. And so the numbers that we're showing obviously fly in the face of what's going on nationally. Nationally, philanthropy for this past year is up about 5%, which is pretty good and better than it has been, and not too bad in such economic times. But to be up 40% really flies in the face of national trends. And I think the reason for that is that people do recognize the importance and the impact that philanthropy has on this university, and related to that, the impact that this university has on the state of Arkansas.
As you mentioned, it flies in the face of conventional wisdom. As the economy has not been robust nationally, what do you think the key is that the University of Arkansas is doing so much better when it comes to raising money and philanthropy than what appears to be happening in the rest of the country?
Well, Kyle, I think there are a couple of things. One, I think that the importance of this flagship land-grant university to the state is recognized and understood by a large number of people. So if you care about the quality of life of the citizens of Arkansas, if you care about the economy in the state of Arkansas, then supporting the work at the University of Arkansas is sort of natural. Secondly, I think that philanthropy and its impact is a proven commodity here. By that I mean that past gifts to the university have funded scholarships, faculty positions, facilities, and people have seen the impact that those gifts have had. So in some cases, an institution might be saying, if you will make this gift, here's what will happen, and it's a hypothetical. In our case, I think people have seen that impact. They know what difference it will make at this university and for our state.
When you do the breakdown by who gave money, 45%, almost half, come from individual alumni, friends, faculty, and staff. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty high percentage.
I think it is. I'm not sure that that's terribly different than a lot of, you know, every university may vary, but, you know, bottom line is individuals are going to make the difference. Corporations and foundations are very generous and support us in many ways, and that's critically important. But I think individuals out there, again, understand and have a passion about the institution and about the state and want to make a difference.
The $121.3 million raised, this is for both academic and athletic programs, correct?
It's for the whole university. Yeah.
The whole university. Any idea what kind of impact, is there any way to gauge what kind of impact a football team going to the first ever BCS contest makes?
Well, I think it helps. It's always better to win than lose. I think that, you know, it's a fun thing to talk about, and people feel good about the university, and we all take great pride in that. And so I think it's certainly a good thing. And it probably does derive some gifts. There probably are some people that have stepped up and made some contributions. But overall, I don't know how much it drives someone that's going to make a million-dollar gift to the history department. They probably take as much pride and enjoyment out of a Sugar Bowl appearance as anyone, but it probably didn't make a difference whether or not they were going to fund that scholarship in an academic area. It's hard to say. Everyone's sure. different, and their motivations are different.
A third of the money that was raised, of the $121.3 million, goes to students and programs. About half will support capital improvements, correct?
That's correct. Yeah, there's a lot of work going on around the university. I think the University of Arkansas and people in the state should be proud of the university's position, that is to try to enhance older buildings as opposed to just blow them down. So a lot of these dollars have gone into renovations of facilities for residence halls and renovating classroom space and auditoriums, and some of it's for new construction as well. But, I think we take a lot of pride in the beauty of the campus and some of the great buildings we have. So while some of them may need to be retrofitted with more modern plumbing, heating, wiring, et cetera, it's better to go in and keep these great old buildings and fix them up for our students.
15% support faculty and staff. I'm sure there are some faculty members who see that and perhaps would wish to themselves or out loud, this is a college campus, that it could be more than a higher percentage than that.
Well, donors support what they're interested in supporting. So, you know, I think in terms of dollar amount, there's a lot of dollars have gone to create new faculty positions, to endow professorships and chairs. And so there's quite several millions of dollars going toward those positions.
Finally, is there any concern that, you know, this is very good news for the university, and is there any concern that through interviews like this or the articles that will follow that you're afraid that some people will get complacent and think, oh, well, the university's fundraising so well, they don't need help?
Well, no, not really. Okay. I think that people that have the wherewithal and the interest in the institution to make gifts, whether it's $10 or $10 million, they're doing it for some of the reasons we've already articulated. They understand the importance of this university to the quality of life to the people of the state of Arkansas. And, you know, any of us in society might say, well, I don't need to do that. Someone else will take care of it. I just don't believe that that's going to happen with the University of Arkansas. It hasn't happened to date. If anything, I think that people hopefully will hear stories and hear about information like this and say, wow, I didn't realize it made such a difference, and I can help a little bit too, because every little bit helps. We've got people that make $5 gifts and people that make $5 million gifts, and it's all important, and it all helps move the University of Arkansas and the state of Arkansas forward.
Brad Choate is the Vice Chancellor for University Advancement at the University of Arkansas. Private gifts to the university for the most recent fiscal year indicate a 40% increase over the previous year. This is Ozarks at Large.
A triple-digit heat wave and lack of significant rain across the state is taking a heavy toll on Arkansas agriculture. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich provides an overview.
Farmers from the Mississippi Delta to the Ozark Highlands have been struggling this year with extreme weather. First, frigid winter temperatures and deep snow fell as far south as Little Rock in February, followed by heavy and prolonged spring rains that filled depleted aquifers and water tables, but also led to late planting in flooded fields. Temperatures quickly rose in early June into the 90s, where they've remained, creeping ever higher, breaking all kinds of heat records across the state in late July and early August. Richard Bell, Arkansas Secretary of Agriculture.
They're all very concerned, both in the crop production, which is on the eastern side of the state, and then the livestock sector, which is on the western side of the state. It's one of those few years where we actually have very intense weather both places. The temperatures have been difficult for the dairy cows, their milk production is way down. The beef cattle are beginning to have to be liquidated because they don't have enough hay and forage, and even now they're asking about water supplies. And on the eastern side, the only crop that's really been in decent condition has been the rice crop, and it's because it's all irrigated.
Poultry producers in northwest Arkansas are seeing high mortality among their flocks. Dr. George Badley, state veterinarian with the Arkansas Livestock and Poultry Commission.
Due to the poultry just overheating in the houses because the fans just can't keep up, and they overheat, and there's been significant death loss in the poultry industry.
50% of a flock or more in some situations, Dr. Badley said, and some poultry houses hold up to 25,000 birds. So in this weather, the ambient temperature can reach 125 degrees.
Their body heat builds the heat up, so it's hard to keep up when the temperature's so high outside.
Trucking crated birds to slaughterhouses in intense heat also poses a challenge.
I understand that they're hauling now at night more, and that some truck drivers for the poultry things are having to stop and water the spray the chickens down with water to make sure that they don't overheat.
Because they can't process a dead bird, yes?
Absolutely not.
Confined hog feeding operations, however, have not been reporting problems.
We have a limited amount of those, and I haven't had any complaints about them. But, I mean, hogs are very sensitive to heat. So, the thing about hogs is you just can't work them up when it's hot because they just can't take it. They overheat very well, very fast. So I know we're going to, and our exhibition, our fair exhibition season is coming up, and we're going to have a lot of trouble with the hogs if it doesn't cool off.
Cattle grazing in open fields with no shade have been dropping from heat stroke in Oklahoma, but seem to be faring better in Arkansas.
We're not having a lot of deaths in cattle, but the pastures have all burned up, and the water table is getting low, so we're going to have trouble if it keeps on with water for cattle, and we'll certainly have trouble with any winter forage or hay because it's non-existent. So, I mean, going into the winter, it's going to be a bad winter unless things change.
With some growers only getting one cutting where they often get three, hay fields are also being plagued by insect infestation. And because pastures are now dormant from heat, cattle ranchers have been forced to supplement with hay and plenty of water.
Well, as long as they have water and can get some relief, some trees, I mean, and horses too. My horses are tolerating it real well. Of course, you can't ride a horse now. But they can tolerate this for quite a while as long as they've got adequate water. That's the key. If you start running out of water or something, you just, a cattle or horses, either one, can't do without water right now.
The western half of Arkansas remains under a severe drought, with 10 more counties in South Arkansas listed as extreme. Expected showers this week ought to ease the situation some, but the state needs prolonged and soaking rains. Field and row crops are also in bad shape, having to catch up from late planting. According to Agriculture Extension crop reports, corn harvests have begun in central and south Arkansas. Cotton is setting bolls, and half the rice crop has seed heads. And while only a quarter of the corn is mature compared to one-third last year, cotton is ahead. Rick Cartwright, Associate Director of Agriculture and Natural Resources for the University of Arkansas Division of Agriculture, spoke via cell while riding in a vehicle to an appointment.
Our rice crop, soybean crop, cotton crop, corn and grain sorghum have all suffered somewhat from the heat and the drought and the problems we had in spring planting with the floods. The drought encompasses most of the state at this point, along with the high temperatures, and it's very difficult to keep up with irrigation demands for those field crops.
Cartwright said grain quality may be diminished this year. Insects also have been a problem on field crops, especially soybeans. Farmers and ranchers have also had to curtail their daily schedules to stay alive. For example, waking up before dawn to work outdoors and coming in before high heat of noon.
These are the kind of real-world conditions that we often forget about when we talk about food production and feed production and fiber production. But this is what farmers face on a year-to-year basis, and it can be pretty daunting for the faint of heart. So we just need to keep these folks that are out there in this heat and drought battling the elements to try to produce our food. We just need to keep them in our thoughts because it's rather difficult life.
Agriculture accounts for more than 12% of the state's GDP, the highest in the Mid-South, contributing more than $17 billion to the state's economy, said State Agriculture Secretary Richard Bell. But this year, he said, we stand to lose at least 10% of that.
And so it's going to have a big impact not only on the farmers themselves, but the related industries like trucking and other hauling and buying for chemicals and so forth. And another thing that worries me is that when you start liquidating your cattle herds, you're actually losing assets because that's what you have for the future. And a lot of the dairy cows are being culled, and it's a desperate situation. It could be very expensive before it's over.
U.S. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack yesterday pledged his commitment to farmers, ranchers, and rural communities, saying that USDA would deliver assistance to those affected by drought and fire, as well as provide continuing help to farms damaged by spring tornadoes and floods. But Richard Bell says low-interest loans, which are typical of that aid, won't be of any use to farms forced to sell off assets just to survive. Reporting for Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Earth, sky.
Predicting the weather, that is predicting the future, really, is a very complex process.
You're listening to NASA scientist Ron Gilero. He leads NASA's efforts to predict weather across the globe. Dr. Gilero said NASA's Aqua satellite makes key measurements used in the computer models that forecast weather.
The Aqua satellite and the instruments on board have given us really a quantum leap in terms of the types of what we call vertical resolution or detail from space of these various parameters, that things like temperature and humidity. And it's key to have this sort of information, to have a complete three-dimensional picture of the atmosphere.
Weather models, said Gilero, are complicated computer programs that follow the equations of science on how the atmosphere works.
If you can tell me the temperature or some other variable now, I can use the weather model to make a prediction of what those fields might look like maybe an hour or 2 hours from now. And then I can take that result, put it back into my computer model, and step out a little further in time. And we repeat that process continuously until we get out to the kind of forecast that people are used to hearing, maybe a day forecast or a five-day forecast. So it's this marching process.
More at our website. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
This is Ozarks at Large. A field trip to the landfill in the middle of the hottest Ozark summer on record. Not at the top of your to-do list? That's exactly what several concerned people did late last month. And Ozarks at Large's energy correspondent, Christina Thomas, tells us the reasons behind the excursion.
To promote the proper disposal of solid waste. Provide assistance for cleaning illegal dumps. Enforce stormwater regulations. And to provide environmental education to all ages of the county. That's the mission statement of the Washington County Environmental Affairs and Recycling Department. As an environmental educator there, it is up to Sophia Stevenson to provide that education. She does outreach to the rural communities in Washington County.
So that can be outreach with the schools where I do, you know, a presentation with kids in a classroom where we do some hands-on activity that has to do with, you know, recycling or natural resources. It could also be outreach to adults, either civic groups like Kiwanis or Rotary or teachers.
As part of that outreach to teachers, Sophie received a grant to organize a field trip and workshop entitled Unraveling the Trash Cycle, held this summer.
We did a pilot program just to see, it was based on an idea from my friend Louise Mann, who's done garbage education for a long time, and she did this with a group of teachers in the River Valley, and I thought it was a great idea. So I tried it with West Fork Schools, partly just I had a good relationship with some of the teachers and administrators there, and they agreed to let me try it. And so then I decided to write a grant for it, and this was the first one that was funded through this grant. And part of that was adding the workshop component of it, and so expanding on just the field trip and adding the second day that was a workshop.
The workshop is intended to help teachers integrate recycling and information about the waste stream into their everyday lesson plans, in order to help make kids aware that they have an impact on our waste stream just like everybody else.
And so using that real-world topic, you can just use that as the context for teaching a math lesson. If you're going to look at numbers, you know, how much waste we create, how much we recycle, how far those recyclables go. You can use it as a science lesson for what things are turned into when they're recycled, a social studies lesson, if you're looking at maybe different cultures or how our trash has changed over time. So there are a lot of different ways you can take that and just put it into the subjects that teachers are already teaching. So it's not an add-on, it's just a different way of meeting those education frameworks that teachers are required to do.
Part of the goal is to not only educate, but to make steps towards achieving more sustainable communities. By putting this information into everyday teachings, the hope is that families will be hearing this from various resources and begin to make a change.
So having teachers with the knowledge to incorporate that into their classroom where it can happen on a more regular basis is part of the goal, and that so then families are hearing it from adults might be getting it from some community message, and then kids are getting it in the school, and so they're getting this message from all these different avenues.
The teachers were chauffeured around Washington County in an air-conditioned bus to places like the Fayetteville Recycling Center to see recycling, a drop-off station, the transfer station, and municipal composting. At the Cooperative Extension Service, they saw composting on a smaller scale. The Washington County Household Hazardous Waste Collection site to see how to dispose of toxic items. They also visited the EcoVista landfill in Taneytown. But before that trip, they received a lecture given by Baridi Nokokeli, Department Director of the Fort Smith Department of Sanitation and the state's largest municipally owned landfill.
Well, what we're going to do is just basically talk about the mechanics of solid waste disposal. You know, we put our trash, our recycling, our yard waste out to the curb, and we're just glad that when we return home from work and school, that it's gone. We don't really think too much about the in-between, the voids that it takes and all the processes. And, of course, when we talk about landfills, let me just start here by just saying that it's not just a dump anymore.
A landfill is actually the burial of waste, the oldest form of ridding of waste. Sanitary landfills, unlike dumps of the past, have physical barriers that prevent the contents from coming into contact with the environment. Baridi likens the liners they use to an above-ground pool.
And for all of the barriers that are in place in a modern sanitary landfill is because it needs to protect groundwater and aquifers. And Fort Smith landfill resides over a very large aquifer that receives its charging out of Oklahoma, eastern Oklahoma, and it exists somewhere between 300 and 1,000 feet beneath the landfill. And of course, we don't want that waste to continue to migrate down and come in contact with groundwater.
But water does come into contact with the waste, often by way of rain. That highly contaminated water is called leachate. Water that has come into contact with the waste, penetrated through it, and come out on the opposite end. All sanitary landfills have leachate collection systems to keep it out of the groundwater. Landfills also produce gas, methane gas. There has to be systems in place to collect that as well. Before Baridi's time at the Fort Smith landfill, they had been burning the gas to rid of it. He came up with a more efficient way to dispose of it.
I decided when I came on board in 2005 that we could do better than that. And in fact, we could clean that gas up and make it pipeline grade and sell it. And of course, we're selling ours to AOG. And people are always surprised to find out that their homes are being heated and they're cooking their meals on gas that's derived in part from the Fort Smith landfill.
During the drive-through tour of the EcoVista landfill, the landfill owned by Waste Management in Tontytown, Sophie pointed out the things that Baritti had talked about during his lecture.
So straight ahead, you can see the gas recovery. And this is what I was talking about, where they're going to use the methane gas to power some homes from that. And landfills can get a credit for that as being a renewable energy source, which I think is kind of debatable of whether that's actually renewable energy to use gas from a landfill. But it's better, I would say, than it just being flared, which is what happened before. It was just being burned off. So at least they are using it for something right now. And I don't know, like I said, if that's actually in production yet or not. If it's not, it will be really soon.
Baritti taught that landfills are divided into different sections for the numerous types of trash. Each type is called a class.
It's called Class 1. And class 1 actually just refers to the fact that it can receive all waste, whether it's petrichable, high in organic matter and content, or non-petrichable, which could be construction demolition material, sand, rocks, things of that nature. And, of course, as it says there, they are physically and chemically stable, and they undergo minimal decomposition, if any.
All Class 1 waste that is collected has to be covered at the end of each day, under 6 inches of dirt. Covering the trash each day keeps rodents and bugs away, but also ensures that odor is under control. If a sanitary landfill is properly maintained, there is no odor at all. At EcoVista, the topsoil is collected through the digging of the hole for the location of the next new landfill.
This is a giant Tupperware of trash over here, pretty much.
That's Sophie, pointing out an old Class 1 landfill on the tour of EcoVista.
And this is what it'll be. So this is after it's full. It's as high as they can go with their permit. They've covered it with more soil, another liner, and then put grass on it. And that's what happens. This one, they just closed a few years ago.
It looks much like a naturally occurring hill, but with pipes sticking out of it in order to maintain the leachate and gas collecting. Even after the closure of a landfill, federal regulations require that they are still maintained and tested for 30 years. Though both the Fort Smith landfill and EcoVista have enough empty permitted acreage to grow for many more years, Baritti points out the goal and the reason Sophie is providing education on this subject.
Our challenge, of course, is to reduce the amount of solid waste disposal. That's what Sophie, that's what everyone here is interested in. Waste diversion, waste minimization, recycling. We're trying to find a way to go away from disposing waste.
Sophie says that there were about 20 participants on the trash field trip from places like Prairie Grove and Greenland. Jennifer Dowdle, a media specialist librarian from Elkins, is looking for ways to incorporate more of this science into her lessons and to help with the school's recycling program, which started last year.
This was very interesting to come around and see just what's available in the area.
One visit stood out the most to her.
The hazardous waste thing that we did in the very beginning, I thought that was very interesting because, you know, you don't know what to do with that stuff. And so to be able to know that, hey, you can take your paints and your batteries and your bulbs that you're not supposed to put in the trash can, you're going, now what do I do with it? It's nice to know there's a place here that you can do that.
The teachers also received supplemental materials, like lesson plans and information on resources in their towns. Sophie and Washington County Environmental Affairs and Recycling are always available to provide additional support. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Christina Thomas.
Christina Thomas is energy correspondent for Ozarks at Large, and support for her work is provided in part by Energy Corps.
It's Tuesday, August 9th, 2011. Joining me now in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Becca Bacon-Martin, editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers.
You know how you can tell it's August?
Because it's hot.
Well, other than that, that's true. It's time for the Grape Festival.
Yeah,
in
Tontytown. Just wondering about that.
Starts tonight with Carnival Armband Night from 4:30 to midnight.
Mm-hmm.
A grape stomp from 7 to 9.
Is that new? I don't.
Weren't you and Anthony wanting to stomp?
Yes. I'm thinking maybe we'll go in September because Cowie Winery has one.
But if you go to this one, you get, like when you step out, you get to make your footprint. So you have this official proof that you stomped.
See, I was unaware of this one, so maybe I will add this to my list as well.
And they also have live music from 7 to 11 with the Boston Mountain Playboys and Jamie O'Neill. This, of course, takes place next to St. Joseph Catholic Church in Tontytown.
Mm-hmm.
Going is free.
Yes.
Other things cost money. And you can find out more at TawnytownGrapeFestival.com. Today is the Taste of Crawford County in Van Buren at the high school. And there will be food served in the Commons area until 1, and then again from 5 to 7. It benefits CASA, and it's $10. Mm-hmm. And Randall Shreve is in concert tonight at 7 o'clock at Mount Sequoia, and it is free. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the second night of auditions for Painting Churches at the Art Center of the Ozarks in Springdale. So you can go out and stomp grapes or listen to music or audition for a play.
Excellent. Thank you, Becca. Becca Bacon-Martin is the editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Callums. With me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Wayne Bell. He writes the column Culture Club for FayettevilleFlyer.com. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Are you enjoying your first day back from vacation or your first week back?
I am enjoying it. It's always good to go on vacation, but it's always good to come back.
Well, we're glad to have you back.
Well, thank you. And you're ready to just launch me on into the rest of August.
Yeah, it shouldn't take too long because August is kind of worse than even July as far as what's going on or what we can spend our dollars on. But, you know, this past weekend, Planet of the Apes, Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Mm-hmm.
anything that has two of those in it.
Did you see that?
No, did fairly well. And actually, the reviews were pretty good for it. I mean, surprisingly.
I'm someone who actually went to the movie theater to see most of the first movies in that franchise, Battle of the Planet. So I'm kind of excited, but I haven't seen it yet.
You haven't seen it? Yeah, right. And it's got Andy Serkis or whatever who did Gollum and Lord of the Rings. So, I mean, he's really an expert at that stuff. It did pretty well. And the other one that did fairly well over the weekend was that Change Up, which is an R-rated kind of switching personalities thing with
one guy's
Jason
married,
Bateman.
Right.
Yeah, and Ryan Reynolds. And it did fairly well, but... and then the other big thing that happened over the weekend was Lollapalooza is in Chicago. And so a ton of acts, you know, participate in that. But moving forward today, the new album from Jay-Z and Kanye West comes out, Watch the Throne, which I guess could only be considered a disappointment. I mean, because of all the hype, it could only be a disappointment.
Expectations
are really high, and the listening parties that have happened with music editors and stuff have said that it delivers. So it'll be interesting to see when you put two, you know, powerhouses like that together to see what happens. And then coming out on Friday the 10th is The Help with Viola Davis and Emma Stone and Cicely Tyson and Allison Janney. And it's got a huge cast. And it was a really beloved book that sold really well. So it'll be interesting to see how it's turned, you know, onto the screen. I'm beginning to think, though, you know, releasing it in August, it's kind of no man's land. So I don't know if the studio doesn't think it's excellent or what. But
or maybe they know there's an audience out there that doesn't want to see...
That's true.
The R-rated comedy, the superhero, or the Cowboys and the Aliens.
Well, like I said last week, if you're looking for something different now, go see Crazy Stupid Love, because it's really good. But, you know, I love Viola Davis, so it'll be interesting to see what happens there. On the 19th, Spy Kids 4 comes out.
Is Antonio Banderas in this one as well?
Yeah, and... you know, I can't say anything about that, except if you have children, I guess you can take them to go see Spy Kids 4. And then on the 26th, Our Idiot Brother with Elizabeth Banks and Paul Rudd comes out. And it's been receiving a lot of kind of publicity. Paul Rudd kind of plays a stoner, loser type brother with a big heart. And, you know, all his sisters have to take him in.
Well, Paul Rudd and Elizabeth Banks, I find both very likable on screen.
I do. And, you know, I've liked Paul Rudd for a long time, even back when he was on Friends, and Elizabeth Banks is on 30 Rock occasionally. And so, I mean, that could be good.
You don't have five.
On the 26th, also, the Dave Matthews Band caravans in New York City, and I think that that's supposed to be televised. They've got some big concerts in New York City with the Roots. And then on the 28th, the MTV Video Music Awards for the channel that doesn't play any video music.
Exactly.
But, you know, recently turned 30 and didn't even acknowledge it. They put it on, they put a 30th anniversary special on VH1 Classic, but they didn't even acknowledge it on their own network.
Because 30 is so old for their target demo?
I don't know. But, you know, the one thing that MTV can always deliver on is the Video Music Awards every year. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't matter what else they have going on, from Jersey Shore to, you know, what other crap they're running on TV. They do deliver on that, and you think back to iconic moments in, you
Madonna.
Know, past award shows. You've got Madonna coming out of the cake, Madonna and Britney Spears. Mm-hmm. You know, and you look back at all these past award moments, and there's some huge ones that came. Kanye upstaging Taylor Swift. So you've got some huge moments that come out of that show.
And what's interesting, the Video Award Show is about the only time on MTV now when they will acknowledge music's past.
Mm-hmm.
It's still a big deal if someone like Madonna or Tom Petty or someone like that shows up.
Yeah.
They still...
And they do. And so this year, leading the field are Katy Perry, kind of on the tail end of that Teenage Dream album that came out last year, but also Adele.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this is going to be a start of 6 months where we see Adele winning everything from, you know, the
right.
Grammys to the American Music Awards to... So... this will be the start for her. And then at the end of the month, on the 30th, both Glenn Campbell comes out with Ghost on the Canvas, and the Red Hot Chili Peppers come out with I'm With You.
Now, is this Glenn Campbell release, is it kind of like what Johnny Cash and Neil Diamond
yeah,
and people like that have done, where they're kind of reforming,
mm-hmm.
you know, their...
Yeah, I think that that's the direction that's going in. And then the Red Hot Chili Peppers, I can't remember their last album. It may have been Stadium Arcadia, which came out in 06. I don't know if they had anything past that.
I know this will be their 10th overall.
Okay. So, and, you know, Stadium Arcadia got, you know, really good reviews. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, if this can back that up.
Well, and it's been very interesting to see the Chili Peppers age.
Yeah.
And still stay creative and still stay relevant. Not an easy thing to do.
Yeah. So that wraps up the month. And as far as other, you know, kind of other kind of stories of interest that have come out in this past week that, you know, the Motion Picture Academy has come out and they've said who's going to receive their honorary Oscars next year. And it's James Earl Jones and Oprah Winfrey, which is interesting. I mean, I look at that and I know that there's humanitarian work involved there, but I don't necessarily see either of them as huge film presences. I mean, he's, I think, been nominated for one Oscar, and she's been nominated for one Oscar, and she's done maybe three movies, and he's more known for narration, but they're humanitarians.
Right.
Obviously.
Well, yeah, and of course you thank Darth Vader
mm-hmm.
for James Earl Jones.
Yeah. And
the voice.
So that's kind of interesting. And then they also announced that Brett Ratner is going to produce the Oscars next year. And he's, you know, a man that's behind a lot of big action movies. So I don't know if this is a last-ditch effort after the James Franco and Anne Hathaway thing or what they're trying to do. But it definitely seems like they're trying to set a mood early to prepare for this upcoming film season. And looking at August, I mean, it's pretty bleak. We can only hope that September, October, and then officially November and December get better. So there's what you can look forward to in August and a little bit ahead.
And cooler temperatures are eventually going to get here.
Tell that to my garden.
Okay.
And my lawn.
That's right. Wayne Bell writes the column Culture Club, found at FayettevilleFlyer.com. This is Ozarks at Large. We continue our week-long drive along Route 66 now. On Main Street in Miami, Oklahoma, a street literally stamped with Route 66 emblem, is the Coleman Theater. The venue opened to a packed house of 1,600 in April 1929. Although it never closed, it endured leaky roofs and partial decay. Now, it's a link between Miami, Oklahoma's past and future.
Right now, you're still standing in an 82-year-old building. Now, when we cross over this seam over here, you're going to be in a brand new building.
Glenn Redding is on the second floor of the Coleman Theater. On one side, a brand new ballroom that's bringing new activity to the town of 13,000. On the other is the Coleman itself, constructed under the guidance of George L. Coleman. Coleman and his brother moved to the Miami, Oklahoma area around 1900. Two 50-something bachelors trying to make a living digging water wells. Their lives changed when they discovered one of the world's largest lead and zinc deposits. Soon, they were making $1 million a month. Bachelorhood soon ended, and George Coleman and his wife began taking the train to San Francisco, Chicago, and New York to see the best vaudeville acts. But the Colemans tired of traveling far from home, and George wanted to sign top acts to come to him and his two small theaters he'd built in downtown Miami. That offer was turned down because those theaters were too small. Glenn Redding, tour guide and Coleman Theater historian, picks up the story.
So he contacted the Senior Orpheum Vaudeville Circuit out of New York City that had contracts for some of the biggest stars in America to be sent out to theaters. He offered them big money to come perform here, and they turned him down. They said, sorry, Mr. Coleman, the type of stars that we represent, we do not send to little rinky-dink theaters like the Glory Bee out in the middle of nowhere. These type of stars have to have a theater like we have here in New York City. He says, no problem, Uncle, build one.
He did. He signed Top Talent to perform 1 year later, and he contracted the Bowler Brothers of Kansas City to build his grand theater. They completed the job in just 130 days. It opened with 1,600 seats on April 29, 1929, with live acts and the silent film The Dummy, starring Frederick March and Zazu Pitts. The theater would host silent films and live acts for the next 10 years until George Coleman retired to Florida and leased it to an out-of-town company that began showing first-run sound movies. As radio and TV cut into the attendance, the Coleman sagged. The roof leaked, and on stormy nights, only seats under the balcony provided dry conditions.
If you came to the movies when it was raining, you had to sit under the balcony to stay dry or bring an umbrella. The balcony would catch the rainwater, ran over to a fire exit door and out like the downspout on your house.
Though it never closed, the theater eventually fell back into the hands of the Coleman family, and after careful negotiations, the family donated the space to the city of Miami. 22 years later, the Coleman is thriving.
Repaint and re-gold leaf the theater here because of the water damage. It had not been painted since 1929. Now, that took several years and several dollars to get that done.
Glenn Redding says the slow revival has been fueled by volunteers and without major corporate donors. And he says the work has been achieved with the help of what he terms miracles. Miracles like the woman who found a program from the first night among her mother's belongings, or the small sample of carpeting saved from ruin in an upstairs closet that allowed workers to recreate the exact design for the lobby floor. Then there's the original marquee, torn down in the 1950s. A plain folder marked marquee discovered in a file cabinet offered some clues about that first marquee.
And we found out that the Norman Corporation out of Nevada, Missouri had made and installed it, and they're still in business today after over 115 years. We call them and ask them, can you make us a marquee like 1929? Because we know the numbers of the molds that you used. And they said, we threw those away 50 years ago. But our guys are good enough. You send us the original specifications and an old picture, we'll make one so close that most people will never know the difference. And we said we can live with that. About 2 weeks later, they called back and said, guess what we found in the old warehouse? We found the molds for the old marquee. So our marquee out in front is exactly like the one in 1929 because it came out of the same mold. Now, the most common word said up here at the top of the stairs is wow. And I've heard it in about 20 different languages this summer.
A short walk up the steps reveals not only a grand theater space, but another of the miracles Glenn Redding says keep coming. A 2,000-pound, 12.5-foot-tall, 10.5-foot-wide chandelier hangs over the balcony. The original was removed in 1963 for fear it might fall. Then it disappeared. Years later, an odd metal form was found under rotting hay in a horse barn formerly owned by the Coleman family. It was the base for the chandelier.
We get excited. We can get it replicated. We do a research and we find out that it had been cast in Italy. We said, what a break. Because somebody here had a brother in Italy. So we sent him on a mission. Find the foundry and find the molds. We get it recast. Well, he can't find a trace of it. He can't even find a little Italian that ever heard of it. So we cannot restore it without the molds. It's gone forever. It'll never hang again. The best we can do is put an old picture of it in the lobby and show people what it used to look like.
Later, a group from Columbia, Missouri toured the Coleman. A woman in that delegation asked why a theater in Miami, Oklahoma, had a picture of the chandelier that was actually hanging in Columbia. She had some interesting information to share.
She says they not only built a theater like this for us, they made us a chandelier exactly like that. And those molds that you're looking for in Italy are not in Italy, they're in Columbia, Missouri. Would you like to borrow them?
The short answer, yes. Still later, in the midst of 6 tons of debris pulled from the attic, the original candle lights were found. But the most fantastic find was still to come. The original Wurlitzer organ that had accompanied so many silent movies had gone missing as well. For 12 years, the Friends of the Coleman Theater pursued it. A series of connections led to a man in Burleson, Texas. He owned the original, and he offered for $100,000 to restore the organ and then install it inside the Coleman. A town of 13,000 needs some time to raise $100,000, and in the interim, another party offered 3 times as much to purchase the instrument. But the Texas owner kept his pledge, and eventually spent 6 months installing the original pipes and all. And this organ, that's an actual recorded performance you're hearing, is no simple collection of pedals and keys. With certain levers switched off, it is a regulation pipe organ. With those levers activated, an entire orchestra is under command. Hit the right key, and an actual snare drum is struck in an unseen room, reverberating around the theater.
Up in that room up there is a real snare drum with 2 drumsticks. You hit the right key. If you know how to do them, you can get a drum roll, which I'm not very used to. Tom Mix was fighting the Indians, and they needed the tom-tom. Or you needed a Chinese block.
Tom Mix was not only seen on the silver screen, he was one of many stars to get ready in the still-existing dressing room just off of the stage.
Now this is the star's dressing room, the biggest star of the show, because it's the closest to the stage floor. The big star always got that dressing room. If you were the second biggest star, you took a flight of steps right up there. Third biggest star took another flight of steps. Fourth biggest star, another flight of steps. The lesser of a star, the farther you are from the dressing room. And as you found out, when you walk in here, you're standing in some famous footprints because you're standing exactly where Bob Hope and Bing Crosby were here many times. Harry Blackstone Sr., Tom Mix, some famous hoof prints out here. He rode his horse Tony out on the stage. Sally Rand, the fan dancer, the little burlesque girl from the 20s. She performed here several times. But she always had to wear a flesh-colored bodysuit because there's a city ordinance against nude dancing in Miami. I think in other cities she needed a feather in the right place. Cary Grant was here. So was Doris Day. And that was before she was Doris Day. Will Rogers performed in here. Then people like the Three Stooges, Larry, Curly, and Moe.
Plus the Ziegfeld Follies and the Little Rascals. There are dozens of great stories associated with the Coleman. Oklahoma's own Will Rogers played there, despite plane problems that forced him to land in a farmer's field and not at the local Miami airport. Oh, and that farmer didn't have a car.
But he's got a tractor. So he puts Will Rogers on the tractor, drives him into the Coleman Theater. Well, they're still out at the airport. No phones. Finally give up, come in. They find him on the ground across the street down playing marbles with a bunch of little kids. They get him up, bring him in. He does his act, or he starts to do his act. Hollers, wait a minute, jumps off the front stage, runs out the front door. He had forgotten his marbles. He went back out and got them from those kids. And sitting in the audience is this 15-year-old boy, Charles Banks Wilson, the artist, makes some sketches. After it's over, he goes home and he paints a picture of Will Rogers.
That picture can be seen in the lobby. And a tour of the Coleman allows visitors to see other hidden spots, like the trap door Harry Blackstone used to make people disappear, or the original light switchboard that had a phone allowing stage managers to talk directly to the projectionist, or even George Coleman at his house. An amazing touch for 1929. And the Coleman still serves as a stage for entertainment, from Tulsa Light Opera to the Platters to a Sousa Night. The seats have been redone. Now the seating is 1,100. A new ballroom opened just this year, and it's bringing weddings, proms, and statewide conventions to downtown Miami. You can learn more about the Coleman's past and present at the theater's website, ColemanTheater.org. and there are several more great stories associated with the theater. You can hear many of those online at OzarksAtLarge.com. And our trip along Route 66 crosses into Kansas tomorrow when we visit one of the oldest continuously operating general stores along the Mother Road.
You get calls from companies, you know, that are logistics. They deal with, you know, merchandising, and they ask you all these questions. Says, well, what kind of store are you? Are you a supermarket or a blah, blah, blah? I said, no, we're a grocery. Well, what's that? I said, we're what it was before all these other things came along.
This is Ozarks at Large. Legendary Asleep at the Wheel with their version of Get Your Kicks on Route 66. This is Ozarks at Large. Because of time issues, unable to bring you today's edition of Writer's Almanac with Garrison Keillor. It will return tomorrow. Ozarks at Large is brought to you in part by the Center for Arkansas Regional Studies at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, dedicated to the celebration and documentation of this region's history and culture. The 16th Annual Ozark Guidance Golf Tournament is Monday, August 22nd at the Springdale Country Club. Registration deadline is Monday, August 15th, and a variety of sponsorship levels are still available. Proceeds to benefit mental health services for children and families. For more information and registration, you can go to the web, ozarkguidance.org. Couple of reminders of events taking place in the next 36 hours or so. The Creative Economy Action Group, a local nonprofit organization hosting the Last Night New Year's Eve Festival in the Fayetteville Square, is seeking input and opinions from local citizens tonight. The Planning Committee is holding a public brainstorming meeting tonight at 6 at the Walker Room inside Fayetteville Public Library. Local citizens interested in sharing their opinion, participating, or volunteering for Last Night are encouraged to attend. If you'd like more information, online, lastnightfayetteville.com. The Northwest Arkansas Women's Shelter Thrift Store is hosting their annual summer bag sale tomorrow through the 12th. For $5, you can fill a grocery bag with any clothing, shoes, and purses. The store is at 1639 North Arkansas Street in Rogers. All proceeds benefit the shelter to help serve victims of domestic violence. For more information, you can call 246-9999. And artist Cynthia Dollard will be at the Newton County Library Friday evening at 6 to share her artwork and offer a program titled Practical Creativity, Integrating Principles of Art into Everyday Life. She'll offer information on a wide variety of topics, including art methods and materials. Events at the Newton County Library are, of course, free and open to the public. Speaking of Newton County, almost the entire Ozarks at Large staff will be there this afternoon and Jasper working on stories for an upcoming edition of Jasper at Large on KUAF. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, Clifty, a listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. I'm Kyle Kellums for Antoinette Grajeda. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great Tuesday. We'll be back with another new edition of Ozarks tomorrow. This is Ozarks at Large for Tuesday, August 9th, 2011. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Later on this edition of Ozarks at Large, how the continued hot, dry weather is making life hard for area farmers and ranchers. And we'll keep moving along Route 66 and take a tour of the restored Coleman Theater on Main Street in Miami, Oklahoma.
First, fundraising news from the University of Arkansas today. University officials announced this morning that the U of A's just completed fiscal year yielded private gifts of more than $121 million. That's an increase of 40% over the $86.7 million raised in the previous fiscal year. Brad Choate is the Vice Chancellor for University Advancement.
Well, I think by any measure, the University of Arkansas is doing well, particularly with philanthropy. But if you look at the quality of the faculty, the quality of the students, the numbers of students, the fact that the quality of the student body and the size are increasing significantly at the same time is really quite a statement. I mean, if an institution wanted to increase its student body size, all you'd have to do is reduce the admissions criteria. Well, you know, the quality of this student body is the highest it's ever been. And I think the faculty would probably agree that the quality of the faculty is the highest it's ever been. So, you know, we're proud of what's going on around here. We think we've got a great institution, and we're just going to get better.
The $121.3 million in private gifts for the fiscal year ending June 30th represents the largest fundraising total outside of a capital campaign in school history. The 40% increase far outpaces the national increase of 5.2% for gifts to education.
I think that, you know, we're just proud and thankful that so many kind philanthropists have supported the university so in such a magnificent way. The university is clearly an economic engine and clearly has a significant impact on the quality of life of all Arkansans, and I think that people have stepped up and voted with their checkbook, frankly. And so the numbers that we're showing obviously fly in the face of what's going on nationally. Nationally, philanthropy for this past year is up about 5%, which is pretty good and better than it has been, and not too bad in such economic times. But to be up 40% really flies in the face of national trends. And I think the reason for that is that people do recognize the importance and the impact that philanthropy has on this university, and related to that, the impact that this university has on the state of Arkansas.
As you mentioned, it flies in the face of conventional wisdom. As the economy has not been robust nationally, what do you think the key is that the University of Arkansas is doing so much better when it comes to raising money in philanthropy than what appears to be happening in the rest of the country?
Well, Kyle, I think there are a couple of things. One, I think that the importance of this flagship land-grant university to the state is recognized and understood by a large number of people. So if you care about the quality of life of the citizens of Arkansas, if you care about the economy in the state of Arkansas, then supporting the work at the University of Arkansas is sort of natural. Secondly, I think that philanthropy and its impact is a proven commodity here. By that I mean that past gifts to the university have funded scholarships, faculty positions, facilities, and people have seen the impact that those gifts have had. So in some cases, an institution might be saying, if you will make this gift, here's what will happen, and it's a hypothetical. In our case, I think people have seen that impact. They know what difference it will make at this university and for our state.
When you do the breakdown by who gave money, 45%